Welcome to the Whose Body Is It podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Malbin. For those who don't know me, I'm a birth worker, a life coach, hypnotist, and a former liberal feminist turned radical truth teller. On this podcast, I expose the forces at play attempting to control our minds and bodies, such as transgender ideology, pornography, prostitution, and so much more. Together, we'll untangle patriarchal lies as you listen to jaw-dropping interviews with women from around the world. Warning, while listening to this podcast, you might find yourself triggered or perhaps notice where you've been biting your tongue on the issues that matter most to you. In my coaching and hypnosis, I help women and men stop getting triggered by every single thing, cultivate resilience, stop unwanted behaviors, and increase self-confidence. You can book your first session at whosebodyisit.com, and you can find that link in the episode show notes. And I just want to say that it's because of your endless support that I'm able to interview amazing women, get their stories out, and produce regular episodes for you. So with that being said, please like, comment, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. And if you're listening in, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And also consider making a financial contribution via the link in my show notes. You can also visit my activist sticker shop. My pro-woman stickers have the power to intercept transhumanist programming. So take a photo of your stickers out in the wild and tag me on Instagram at Whose Body Is It. Without further ado, let's get into this week's story. After last week's deadly shooting at the Covenant School in Nashville, Tennessee, there was a lot of confusion about the sex of the shooter, Audrey Hale. Was it a man? Was it a trans man? Are they a man pretending to be a woman or a woman pretending to be a man? It makes you wonder if the confusion is actually a critical part of constructing a narrative where trans-identified people can't be held accountable for their actions. And in fact, today's guest, Robbie Rose, points out that CBS was intentionally not reporting the sex of the shooter. Just as the media obscured the identity of trans-identified female school shooter Alex McKinney in Colorado in 2019. Robbie Rose returns to the podcast for an enlightening discussion of the profiles of school shooters in recent history. She points out that most school shooters were bullied for being gay, whether or not they were, and that they also often struggled with autism and behavioral problems. Society's answer to mental health issues is to medicate these children and young adults, and Robbie notes that these people are being given a cocktail that has never been tested, one of antidepressants, mood stabilizers, legal methamphetamines, and more recently steroids in the form of synthetic testosterone. Robbie takes us through a concise history of autism, causes of traumatic brain injury, and asks why the media never seems to highlight the fact that these people are highly medicated. She also leaves us with the question, is trans ideology a massive cover-up for widespread legal poisoning? Before we get into the kind of the pharmaceutical connection, the autism connection between what's going on and gender dysphoria, trans ideology, mass shooting, psychosis, all of that, I just want to name that I think the confusion inducing aspect of all of this, right, is by design, right? Like, it is so bizarre to not even be able to find the words to describe what's happening. Like what we saw, like we couldn't even get into all of these like advanced critiques, like what we're going to do in this episode before even gathering enough information to be like, wait a minute, is this a female or is this a male? Let's just start there. So Robbie, thank you for taking the time to just help us unload this from your particular vantage point, which is so valuable that I don't see anywhere else. So will you first just introduce yourself and talk about why or kind of where you're coming from in your particular analysis of this Audrey woman?
Yes. So I'm Robbie Rose, and you and I have had a couple of conversations in the past spanning many different topics, from vaccine injury and allergies to the hoax around me getting a service dog for my son that could detect peanuts. So I have been interested for several years in the issue of school shooters and the ties that they have to pharmaceutical drugs, the legal pharmaceutical drugs that we're giving kids. And I think the last time we spoke, and I don't know if this was during the recorded interview or something separate, that I believe that I told you that all of the school shooters, if not, maybe not 100%, but maybe 100%, but most, have been bullied for being gay. Whether they are
Yeah.
gay or not gay, they're bullied for being gay. And I'm not sure that you believed me in the moment. I think there might have been some like, huh, are you sure? And I've been emailing you when it happens, and I'm like, you see, you see, you see. So when this happened, I was just at the point where, okay, I'm going to start really looking into this. And so then this is where you and I are having a conversation about these kids. And it's not, and I want to be very careful to say, having a gay child or having a child who is suffering from gender dysphoria and feels that they are trans is not the problem here. They're not the threat to the school. The threat to school and the threat to safety are the kids who are on a whole bunch, like a cocktail that has never been tested of, right, antidepressants and mood stabilizers and ADHD meds, right? Throw in some whatever, lithium and Xanax and legal methamphetamines. And we're just putting these kids, I've never seen a study to show that this is safe. It's obviously not safe. When this is, at this point in time, the profile of school shooters, it's proven not to be safe. And so we need to pivot very quickly as a society, or I mean, no one's going to have their kids in schools anymore. Like, what's headed our way is absolutely terrifying, and we have to start naming it and being honest about it, and the pharmaceuticals industry's role in it, but the parents' role in signing up for this stuff and allowing their kids to take these drugs, right? Pharma that gets away with this because there's a demand for the drugs. But if the teachers and the school leadership and the parents and the counselors and the pediatricians all say, we're not doing this anymore, then this will stop. So no one's coming to save us. We have to start doing something about it.
Yeah. And everyone wants to change the kid. Nobody wants to change the environment. I mean, the messaging, with all the trans stuff is, your body is the problem, right? Your body is the problem. Your mind is the problem. We're gonna connect the two. There's a disconnection, and we're gonna help you connect the two via all of these drugs. And we're gonna try some out. We're gonna adjust the dose, and it's all very ethical because you come and see, the stranger in an office without your parents once a week. And so it's all very ethical as long as it's being monitored and dosed. And we're just gonna figure it out together. I mean, those are the messages that these kids are getting from psychiatrists, from pediatricians, and general practitioners. So yes, we had, and I'm gonna link our previous two episodes in the show notes. So for anyone who hasn't listened to those, definitely you're in for a wild ride. I don't even think they made it on YouTube. I'm pretty sure one, if not both, were removed from YouTube. So you will not, I don't think you'll find those on YouTube. I will not be posting this to YouTube as well. So this will be going on podcast platforms only. And so let's maybe start with what you found out about this woman Audrey Hale, the
Yeah.
shooter for the last kind of school shooting.
So at this point, when we hear that there's a female shooter, I think we can all rest assured that it's not going to be, a little girl who got upset about something and just momentarily lost her mind. That's not what's happening. There is a constellation around these kids, And it is probably 100% of the time that there's a constellation around these kids. And so it wasn't a surprise to me. A couple of things were not a surprise to me. Number one is that there's been some coverage on Twitter about how CBS tried very hard not to report that this girl, Audrey Hale, was experiencing gender dysphoria, even though she had her own LinkedIn up where she had male pronouns up. CBS wanted to say that they had not confirmed her gender identity and not to report on it. So here we are again, just like for the last couple of decades, where you have mainstream media protecting the sexual orientation as a whole. You know, this, like, Audrey is gone. There's no protecting Audrey. Like, why are you doing this? You're doing this for a much larger reason, that you're trying to protect a movement, right? Whether it's gay rights or trans rights. And so CBS was caught. Like, there was a memo and it was leaked where they're telling the reporters to stop reporting on that. So it's not a surprise to me, because I knew that this is part of the constellation. This female is going to be a female who is suffering from gender dysphoria, and she's going to be self-identifying as male. And that came out pretty quickly. And then the second one was later that night, a family friend told the Daily Beast that she had high functioning autism. And high functioning autism is what used to be called Asperger's syndrome up until, seven, eight, 9 years ago. It was its own separate syndrome. And so Asperger's syndrome is very different than classic autism. Asperger's syndrome is the kids with social differences. They have a hard time telling sarcasm. They're not very good at taking turns in conversation. They might have favorite topics and they want to talk about their favorite topics all the time. They are all on the internet. They are all advocating for themselves. They're the neurodiversity movement. They're on social media. Very, very different than classic autism, which is bowel disease and speech apraxia. You know, there's some overlap, and there has been some overlap for the history of autism that goes back to 1932. And I think it's that overlap that has caused professionals to say, okay, this is a spectrum, but it's not a spectrum. You can't go get therapy for very sick and debilitating classic autism and then one day maybe just only end up with an Asperger's diagnosis. It doesn't work that way. It's not a progression. They're so separate. And so they have a little bit of overlap with nervous system, like sensitive nervous systems and self-soothing, right? So whether it's repetitive movements or if it's being startled by loud noises, you know, who among us isn't startled from loud noises? But there's this little bit of overlap. But apart from that, these two things don't belong under the same autism umbrella. And so anyway, her family friend came forward to the Daily Beast and said she has high functioning autism and she's under a doctor's care. And so here we are. Here we are. So now she's under a doctor's care. What meds is she on? Because there's nothing else a doctor, you know, everything in the diagnostic tree for a medical doctor ends with a prescription. So what is she on? And so that's going to be the constellation, I'm telling you, 100% of the time for school shooters. High functioning autism, whether or not they are diagnosed. A brain injury that led to this diagnosis or that led to these symptoms and behaviors. Mm-hmm. Antidepressants, anti-anxiety, ADHD meds, and or mood stabilizers, right? And it's not going to be one. It's going to be two, three, four, if not more. And now, and not necessarily for Audrey Hale, because we don't know, they're adding in testosterone that causes aggression.
So if we take in how many girls are being medicalized under the guise of trans ideology or gender identity, then, I mean, the conclusion that I would make from what you're saying is that we're just going to see more female school shooters. Would that logic follow that this is just a taste of what is to come? I know there was the McKinney. If you could speak to the other case where it was a duo, there was the...
I mean, that was not far from where I am. And so for that reason, I followed that story very closely. And that was in May of 2019, two school shooters in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, came in and they murdered like this phenomenal kid who was star of, you know, the robotics team and just this beloved guy. They injured eight other kids. And the first photo to come out was of a boy, and we don't know if he's gay or not gay. He had a girlfriend. That doesn't mean anything. He was very, very slight. He weighed 95 pounds, and he had this bright pink hair. It was like half black and half pink. So once you see that, right, that's not an ordinary kid. And once you see that picture, that was it. Media all around just stopped reporting on that. I mean, I've never seen a school shooting disappear faster than the 2019 Colorado school shooting. And so we are told that it was two boys who went and shot up the school. And then it comes out, I don't know, hours or days later, that one of the boys was in fact a girl who was identifying as a boy. And that was it. You didn't hear anything more about this, right? This is, again, the media not protecting the kids who are the victims of so many things themselves. They're not protecting the kids. They're protecting a movement. They're protecting an ideology. And so that was that. I continued to follow the story, though. And it was a really long time later before the nurse of Alec McKinney, who was the female identifying as male, testified that that nurse himself had prescribed ADHD meds to Alec McKinney, in addition to the meds that Alec McKinney was already on, which was anti-anxiety meds and mood stabilizing meds, right? And like, that can be lithium. Like, we don't know what that is. And then on top of that, Alec McKinney was known to abuse Xanax and to abuse cocaine. And I don't believe Alec was on testosterone. Alec was mad at her mom because she wasn't okaying the testosterone. This was 2019. I don't even know if you need permission anymore from your parents. So the media just buried that story. But because of that story, I knew as soon as this tragic shooting happened in Tennessee, we're dealing with the same thing. It's not a coincidence. This is the way it will go moving forward, unless we as a society pull together and put a stop to it.
And the main narrative we hear is that we just, you know, for on the left, it's just gun control. We just need more gun control. And it becomes this like political war around, well, why do people want these mass shootings to continue? Like, it's just, it is so obscured. It's just, it is so infuriating. So, okay. So we know the profile of this woman and what, you know, you're kind of predicting we're going to see more of, but what is the profile? How would you describe the profile of the school shooter that they want us to see? Like, do they want us to see a kind of a gender conforming man who is this like toxic male? Like, do you think that is the profile that they want the public to buy into? Like, how do you think they are successfully obscuring that there is this intersection?
Well, I think it's shifting right before our very eyes. I think they very, very successfully buried the Colorado shooting and everything that came out after that about gender identity and about the drugs. I think they were very good at hiding that. But, you know, we have seen in other school shootings where they try to, or other shootings in general that are not even school shootings, where they try to identify people with Trump supporters or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, no matter how wild, even if you look at like the Nancy Pelosi thing, I mean, they try very hard, right, to get that messaging out there. And as long as they're first to it, it's very successful messaging. But what we're watching right now is a shift where they can't pin this on Republicans and gun lovers and Trump supporters. It's impossible. And so what we saw a couple days ago, right, on Friday, were the trans protesters in the Tennessee Capitol, and they're all holding up seven fingers. Did you see this?
No.
Seven fingers for seven victims is what they were saying. So now they're calling Audrey Hale
a victim.
And I agree, but for completely different reasons. She's a victim of pharma, absolutely.
Right.
But they want to say she was a victim, I don't even know for what, for being bullied. I mean, the woman was 28 years old. I mean, she had to be a decade out of that school if she graduated from that school, right? Like, that's not, I don't know, unless they're trying to say she's a victim of the anti-trans affirmation laws in Tennessee, perhaps. They're trying to say that she's a victim. So they're shifting now to say, you're getting what you deserve because you guys are the ones pushing us into a corner and we right. have no other way to go. Right. And you're dealing with high functioning autistics who are by nature very, very, you know, egocentric as like any human has the tendency to be, right? But there's parts of our brain that put our egocentricity in check and say, okay, it's not all about me, or that's not a normal response. That's not an acceptable response. I can't behave this way, right? But when you're dealing with people who have brain injuries, and all autism is brain injury, I mean, they're not made this way, whether it is something that is happening in the womb or shortly after birth, but this is mm-hmm. all brain injury. And we can get into that in a little bit. But you're dealing with people who do not have the checks and balances system in their brain. And we're seeing online this justification of make yourself heard at all costs. I mean, what is this day of visibility? Sorry, you guys are not invisible. You're not visible to anybody. Like, what is this narrative that you guys are invisible? We all see you. It's very difficult to miss what's happening. And yet there's this story of we're invisible and we have to make ourselves seen. We have to make ourselves heard at any expense. And mm-hmm. so like, are we going to see the media shift along with it and endorse that and say, you guys are pushing these people into a corner and you're going to get what you deserve? I don't know.
Oh, I can hear my former colleagues and friends totally saying that. What do you expect? You know, like, it's so violent. You're depriving these people of their basic human rights, their health care, their, you know, fill in the blank. Yeah, what do you expect? And this should wake you up as to how desperate, you know, these people are. And we do see the desperation, but as you described, like in a different way, in the you know, as described, you know, Audrey being a victim of the pharmaceutical industry. And the only other time I've really heard this talk about is on Kelly Brogan's interview with Joe Rogan, where she talked about this very thing. Not as far deep as we're going now in regards to the trans stuff, but the you know, why is the conversation always around gun control and not around the pharmaceutical industry?
Right. Yeah. And something interesting is that up until the release of the first antidepressant, which was Prozac, there were only 3 shootings in the history of America on school property. 3. That was it. And then Prozac came out in 1988, and there was a shooting in 1998. And then there's another shooting in 1998. And then the one in 89, 91, 92, 96, 96, 97, 97, 98, 98, Columbine in 99. I mean, it's perfectly dovetailed with antidepressants coming into the world. And yet they have successfully hijacked this and renamed it as stigmatizing mental illness. So now you're not allowed to talk about it. But there's no denying it. There were 3 shootings in the history of America on school property, and now they're nonstop.
That's wild.
So no, it's not the guns. It's certainly not the guns.
No.
Not that, I mean, not that I wouldn't be in favor of of course, I would be in favor of anybody who has a mental diagnosis and who's on any psychotropic drug not getting their hands on a gun. Yeah, I would absolutely support that. But that's not what they're asking for, right? Because that's stigmatizing the mentally ill.
You had mentioned to me prior a woman named Brenda Spencer. How does she fit into the history of female shooters and kind of meant the intersection of mental illness and trauma?
I mean, she... People who know her have 2 very different versions of her. I've read about her extensively. And so she's got family who thinks that she's just a liar and that she just makes up absolutely everything. They believe that she's made up wild experiences that happened to her, that she made up the abuse, that she made up the incest, and they believe she's lying about even her drug use. And her friends who know her, who, I mean, we all know that when it comes to between like your friends and your family knowing you, it's quite possible that your friends know you a lot more honestly than your family knows you. Mm-hmm. Her friends have said that I mean, she suffered horrific physical abuse, sexual trauma, incest, and that she was an alcoholic at age 16, that she was a serious drug abuser at age 16. And she had a quote that was just so outlandish at the time that she, what year was it? 1979. She was, when she shot up a school in San Diego, she, from the outside, I don't think she even went inside. And she was just, she had this quote like, well, I hate Mondays. Or, I mean, it's just insane that that's her justification for doing this, right? So obviously not abiding by what we would consider to be societal norms. Yeah. So, you know, but then it gets into the issue of what does trauma do to the brain, right? Because trauma has physical effects on the brain, and you can become brain injured and have brain malfunctions due to the amount of trauma that you have been through. And it's absolutely undeniable. And these things can be confirmed with MRIs, you know, but was she on pharmaceutical drugs? I don't know. She was certainly on, but like, what's the difference? What's the difference between meth and ADHD meds, mm-hmm. like Ritalin and Adderall? You know, structurally, there's not going to be, so it doesn't really even matter. If she's mm-hmm. abusing meth, then mm-hmm. it doesn't mm-hmm. matter which drug dealer gave it to her.
Right. And I know you're going to get into this, but I just had the thought, you know, parents who are struggling, you know, to make their kids fit into an environment, who want them to focus better, or whatever the ask is, you know, we'll get them on, you know, let's say like a focus drug with quotes. And it does the exact opposite from what you've shared. It actually creates the effect of dissociation rather than like integration and focus and like uniting the two. It actually creates more separation. Can you speak to the dissociative side effects of some of these commonly prescribed drugs to children?
So number one, I think we have to recognize and just acknowledge the fact that kids who are suffering from gender dysphoria or any identity disorder are already heavily dissociated. So putting them on one of these drugs is the last possible thing that they need. And I know that this dissociation and embodiment, like these are sort of buzzwords right now. I don't fully grasp, you know, I'm sure it's a huge, huge, huge concept. I don't fully grasp all of it, but I do know from what I've read about like women who are not really connected to their bodies, that sort of thing, that there's things that you can do for yourself, right? And it's mindfulness or it's breath work or it's getting into dance. And like, there's things that are make you more connected, but going on something like an anti-anxiety drug there couldn't be anything worse. There could be no worse step that you could possibly take. So Xanax causes depersonalization. So it's the state where your own thoughts and your own feelings don't seem to belong to you. Right? And that's a terrifying thought, that you could have somebody who is upset, excluded, ostracized, being bullied, all of this, right? And then they have these feelings inside. And then they're almost like witnessing these feelings from the outside and being like, well, those aren't my feelings, you know, but those are definitely some justified feelings. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine the circus that goes on in someone's head when they are suffering from something like depersonalization. And then taking Xanax, will worsen that depersonalization. And then there's derealization, which of course is the perception that what's happening around you isn't even real. You know, it would be more like a dreamlike state. And then Adderall is well documented to cause people who use it to become completely disconnected from the feelings of others. And that's already something that kids with high functioning autism, that's already like a symptom of that disorder, is empathy, sympathy, being able to connect with others, being able to form intimate friendships. Like that's already something that they're struggling with. And then you're going to throw Adderall on top of that and you're completely disconnected. It almost becomes easy to say, I'm going to make you hurt the way I hurt, and I'm going to make you suffer the way I suffer. I mean, who among us hasn't had those thoughts at 11 or 12 or 13 years old? You know, I certainly had those thoughts. I'm going to make my parents hurt the way they make me hurt. I'm going to get back at them by hurting myself. It's a very normal passage in life, you know, before your brain is even fully developed. And yet you've got these kids now who you see it online. Like, I'm not making this up. They feel justified to make themselves feel understood at any cost. And so this is just the direction that we're going to be going in. And then now with kids who no longer even need to get parental permission to get testosterone, I mean, anybody can look up what transgender kids are suffering from when they're taking testosterone. These girls, not that the female body doesn't have some testosterone in it, we do, but it's not our dominant hormone. And now all of a sudden they're being bombarded with testosterone and they're so angry. They're so aggressive. I mean, I remember once a long time ago, I had an allergic reaction to something and I had to go on steroids for it. And it was 5-day course or something like that. But I had tickets to an Alanis Morissette concert and I really wanted to go. So like at some point in the middle of this course of steroids, I go to an Alanis Morissette. I wanted to get into a fist fight with anybody who stepped back and stepped on my toes, who bumped into me, who looked at me wrong. I mean, I was awful. I can't imagine how these kids feel. And I knew, you know, and I knew it's just the steroids. It's not me. Imagine how they're suffering. Like, no, I mean, I'm not going to say no one, but it just doesn't seem like this is the topic of conversation. These kids are already victims, right? Like, we can get into autism and the causes of autism. Mm-hmm. It's not their fault. They're not made this way. They were not made this way. It's not genetic. There's no genetic component, except maybe like susceptibility to being poisoned. Mm-hmm. It's not their fault. And it's not their fault that they're on these drugs. It's not their fault that they're on the antidepressants and on the ADHD meds and taking things off label that their doctors give to them. We're looking at a medical mafia that it's just an endless cycle of creating the problem and then selling the drugs to treat the problem.
And not so much the parents that I encounter and I work with, but I do hear they need real help. They need real help, but everyone has a different idea of what that real help is. So there are some people who like understand the dangers of the gender identity ideology and who believe the real help is through modern psychiatry, which mm-hmm. is all these drugs that you're describing. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're stuck in this like loop. If you are not critiquing the pharmaceutical industry and in all its tentacles, you know, if you are someone who is dealing with a kid who thinks they're stuck in the wrong body, who is suffering from these delusions, who, you know, whatever, however you want to define it, gender dysphoria, and you are not looking at all the tentacles of this industry, not just the small part that's prescribing wrong sex hormones, you're in big trouble. How are you ever? I mean, this is like a dead end.
So I think that we need to start helicoptering up and saying, what's the bigger problem, right? Because gender dysphoria for many is transitory, right? Whether it's a couple years, you know, give or take, it can be a very transitory phase. As long as that kid is given love and support, taken away from the influences. I'm sure you've read many accounts of moms who just put down like the Berlin Wall basically and mm-hmm. say, you are not going to be looking at Tumblr. You're not going to have unrestricted access to the internet. You have lost all of your social media accounts. You're not going to be affiliating with these kids anymore. You're not going to be in public school, right? And then these girls get through it. And a couple mm-hmm. years later, they're like, thank God, you know, and as long as you can, God, keep out of the court system, you know, and just, you have to go radio silent. Cause if even a pediatrician finds out what you're doing, if a teacher finds out what you're doing, they're going to put the state on you and you're losing your kids and all this. And you have to be prepared for it. And nobody's prepared for it. They don't know. They're not reading about these things the way we're reading about these things. So they're not prepared when it happens to them. But I think that we need to helicopter up And we need to start treating it the way we would treat autism. And by that, I do not mean the pharmaceutical treatment for autism of off-label prescription drugs, but like, what are the crunchy, non-compliant parents doing to treat autism and they're having success at it, right? And so it's going to be nutrition. It's going to be chelating metals out, you know, of course, like an initial test to see if that's something that you even need to do, but there's DMSA, there's the Andy Cutler protocol, there's EVTA IVs at these IV places popping up all the time now. Like I just came through, I just did 12 IVs myself. So I know that this is around, that you can find this, you can do a test and see where your kid is at. But another thing is that there's these like brain feedback places, and I don't fully understand what they are or how they work. One of them is called Brain Balance. I have a friend in St. Louis who went to it, who just thought it was absolutely spectacular. I know people who are taking their kids. It's not cheap, but I just looked it up and I saw that they now have some like home things that parents can be doing. And their website says that they are creating new pathways in the brain. And basically it's never too late, right? And so if you have a brain injury, like let's say, whether it is from aluminum that has destroyed, you know, nerve myelination, whatever it is, if you have a little piece, a little area of your brain that has been hurt, whether it's by mercury, whether it's by aluminum, whether it's by trauma, whether it's from a car accident, you know, for whatever reason, it seems that the brain can make new pathways, but not necessarily on its own. But I mean, a place like this is the support that kids need to create these new pathways so that they are healthier and they can function. And so, you know, that on top of embodiment work, right? So, you know, the breath work or the meditation, dance, whatever it is people are doing to become more connected. You know, if it was my kid, I would pull out all the stops. I would, you know, they would hate me for a little while. I would quit working and I would dedicate myself 100% because, I mean, it's an emergency.
This is not the parenting advice most people have come across who are dealing with this issue. It's just not.
Yeah.
This is just not part of the conversation.
Do you remember the last time we talked, I told you about a study that I had found. It was a single case study from the 1970s, and it was the first case study I found of gender dysphoria in the literature. Mm-hmm. And that girl had high functioning autism, and it was called Asperger's at the time. And I was like, see, there's an overlap. And I've been looking and looking since then, and there absolutely is an overlap. And there was a huge study of 500,000 kids. And so when you're dealing with boys who do not suffer from gender dysphoria, 7% of them are now under the autism umbrella. And that's going to include both classic autism and Asperger's and everything in between. And for girls, it's 4%. So add that up. That's 11% of these kids of the 500,000. But with the kids in the group who suffer from gender dysphoria, who identify as being trans, their autism diagnosis rate was 24%. That is more than double. And I am telling you, and this is going to be my hill to die on, I think it's far, far higher. I would not be surprised if it was 95-98%. I would not be surprised. I think that there can be sexual trauma that we don't even know. Like, we don't even know the fallout of some of the sexual trauma that people endure. And so maybe for that reason, they identify as being transgender. I mean, I've read extensively about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And some of these guys are like, I think I'm gay because of it. I don't think I was supposed to be gay. And now like, that's just where I'm at. So we don't know. Right. So I'm not going to say 100%. I wouldn't be surprised if it's 95-98% have high functioning autism. And they are simply missed. They are missed. And the reason that they're missed is because the entire diagnosis of high functioning autism is built around boys. And it's been built around boys since its existence in 1938 or so is when it came around. And so the man that is named after, Hans Asperger, is Austrian. And he had 200 kids who were these little professors, right? And this is not the classic autism kids. These are the kids who are, you know, talking, and like very egocentric, very fixated on topics that they love. They're not great conversationalists. There's no give and take, right? They miss the social cues, nonverbal communication, facial expressions, all of that. 200 kids with this in Austria in 1938. And they were all boys. And so for that reason, it was just thought that this was a boy thing. And it's not a boy thing. I don't know if it's 50-50. I have no idea. But what we're seeing now, you know, with this rash of females coming to this like British gender clinic that we talked about last time, where they're like, this is the epidemic. It's the girls now. Maybe it's just catching up. I don't know. But if we are really looking at high functioning autism and this thing that is this machine, this diagnosis machine that is entirely built around male symptoms, all of these girls are falling through the cracks. And what is so amazing is this argument. And what are your thoughts on this, on whether there's a social contagion element to gender dysphoria?
I definitely believe, I mean, it resonates just based on how eating disorders spread. You know, like Mary Lou Singleton always says, like, she wouldn't have known what an eating disorder was if she wasn't taught how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're taught, there's a methodology, you go on forums, you share tips on how to do it. So that resonates just based on my experience of how, you know, I experienced like eating habits, eating disorder, dieting, all of that as like an adolescent girl. So that resonates. And I believe in social contagion when it comes to like suicide. You know, Mary Lou Singleton referenced a dancing plague that was the social, was it 1700s or 1800s? But basically people danced themselves to death. They were just dancing in the street until they collapsed. Like they wouldn't eat. It was a socially contagious dancing plague. It sounds totally made up. I thought it was not real.
Wow. And
yeah, it's wild. So I definitely believe in social contagion. You know, Abigail Schreier's book, The Irreversible Damage, definitely resonated. And I don't think it's the full story.
1518.
Thank you. The dancing plate.
Wow. So here's my line of thinking around the social contagion element of girls identifying as boys in clusters. Because that's the only argument, right? I think are the clusters. When you've got girlfriends who are 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, and they all in quick succession are going to these gender clinics. I wouldn't be surprised, as I've said, if 95-98% of these girls have high functioning autism and they're just not diagnosed. And so I started looking into it and like, why is this missed? And some of it is missed because the girls get a different diagnosis. They can get an OCD diagnosis. They can get an anorexia diagnosis. And it's like, all right, that's it. You got your diagnosis and we're done. Right. And isn't it interesting that anorexia, right, and probably body dysmorphic disorder plays into this as an overlap with girls, right? And again, like this is documented brain injuries. Girls with anorexia and body dysmorphic disorder have brain injuries. It's like, I'm just not making this up. People tend to think, I thought, right, that someone having a mental disorder, it means that like they're just wrong in their thinking. They're not wrong in their thinking. They're hurt in their brain and it's causing them to think this way, right? A mental disorder is still going to have a physical cause. So I started looking into it and like, why is this so missed in girls? And so with the boys, right? Like we all know what it looks like with the boys. It's everything that I've already described a couple of times. But with the girls, what they do is they will observe the girls around them and then they will mimic ordinary socially acceptable female behavior. And so when you have a girl who's high functioning autistic, but she's very busy mimicking and presenting herself as being perfectly fine because of what the other girls do, it's just going to be missed. And I know these girls, like I know little girls like this, where I see their moms and I'm like, have you gotten a diagnosis? And I've had parents tell me, oh, well, we're looking at this diagnosis and possibly this diagnosis. And I'm like, yeah, but what about high functioning autism? They're like, no, we're not looking at that. And I'm like, I can just tell by looking at them that I think that you should go talk to someone possibly about this diagnosis, right? Because there's services that are available to these kids, but you can't get them without the diagnosis. And one of the hallmarks of it are girls who will not allow anyone to brush their hair, because the sensory overload of it is just so repulsive to them. And so you have these girls who, at an age where they become more self-aware of their present, you know, outward presentation, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, you have these girls that have rat nests for hair and they don't care at all. Like, that is a hallmark of it. If you don't have a girl that's like transitioned into being more self-aware about her outward appearance, like that is a red flag that you have a kid who's gone probably, you know, missed many years missing this diagnosis and missing out on services. And so girls with high functioning autism, their social skills are more like boys, right? Because the difference between social skills of, let's say, like an 11-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl, or 12-year-old boy and 12-year-old girl, huge differences in social skills. But a girl with Asperger's is going to be more like an ordinary boy. She's not going to be anything like a boy with Asperger's, right? Who's just like standing out like a sore thumb. She's just going to be more like a boy. And people might be like, oh, she's a tomboy, or, you know, like all, there's just all kinds of reasons that you could give for why they would be like that. But inside, they're suffering. Gosh, I just know so many little girls like this. Their reactions to things are just so enormous. And you're like, come on, you're 10 years old. You're 11 years old. Like, get it together. You don't get to act this way. But their reactions are so emotional and they're so intense. And a lot of times as they get to be teens, you know, their friends are like, oh, she's just too much. And it's just missed and it's missed and it's missed. But inside, the girls are struggling with nonverbal communication, sarcasm, being in crowds, sensory disorders, right? Scratchy things. Like I said, you know, the hairbrushing and stuff like that. It's just different than boys, and it's less so. And it's within the realm of kid behavior, even though it's not really within the realm of female behavior. It falls more into the male behavior, but it's still like all normal for being human. Then it's just missed.
And so can I ask you a couple questions before we continue? So your emphasis on these girls, right, your objective for these girls is to get, you know, evaluated and to get an autism diagnosis so that then they can access these treatments that you've seen really improve these kids.
No insurance company is paying for those treatments. I do think socially that they can get help, right? Where they can get a therapist who is able to assist them with social skills. Maybe they get some extra help at school, something like that. They can get that. Yeah, but no.
Where for you does it cross over, you know, between just like variation in personality? Or like, do you find that there's perhaps an overdiagnosis when it comes to autism, or you feel like there's an under, or that maybe the wrong people are being they're like the people who are self-proclaiming themselves as autistic might actually just be like narcissistic, and the girls who are actually high-functioning autistic aren't getting the right diagnosis and therefore aren't, who are kind of falling between the cracks, but you know, because I've heard criticisms on the under end is that like everyone, like too many children are falling this under umbrella. And so where's the line, you know, with just variation in personality and desires and presentation?
I can see both sides of it, absolutely. And I think I've also shifted in what I believe. And also we have to recognize that there's two camps, right? There's the autism parents who have kids who can never learn to use a toilet.
Right.
They're resentful about the DSM-5 creating this umbrella where quirky kids are now getting a similar diagnosis, because unfortunately, it's just destroyed people's perception of what autism is. And I don't know if I told you, years ago, I represented a guy in college who had tried to run over his girlfriend.
Yes.
He had Asperger's. And there was a third person there who was a guy who had Asperger's. They were all in a special program together in a college in San Antonio. And the three of them had gone out where he had a crush on the girl. The girl, I think, maybe liked the other guy, and things are just boiling up. And he got in his car because it felt like the appropriate response was to threaten her with the vehicle and make her think he was going to kill her. He didn't want to kill her. And I struggled with this. You know, this came to me like because a judge knows like who I am and what I do and what I understand. And so that family was sent to me and they hired me. And I remember going in and trying to talk to the prosecutor. Prosecutor wouldn't even hear it. And this was 2012, maybe. The prosecutor didn't want to hear it because already his idea of autism means that you were just smarter than everyone else and you had some sort of savant talent. And here I am dealing with a kid who has so much anxiety, so much paranoia, can't like talk in a straight line. His situation was so bad. And yet there's this prosecutor. And I was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Then we're going to approach the judge and I'm going to let the judge ask him a few questions because I know how it's going to go. It's going to go horrible. And I was like, okay, you know, let's clear it up and get his parents on board and all this. And we're going to approach the judge. And then the judge begins asking him, which is like really unorthodox, what happened? And he's trying to explain what happened. And he just completely veers off and he's talking about being followed and he's talking about helicopters and all this. And I'm just standing there and the prosecutor's like, because this is not what he thought, right? So anyway, the whole umbrella thing, there's a lot of hurt feelings, understandably so. So getting back to your question, is it an overdiagnosis or underdiagnosis? I would have thought years ago that it was an overdiagnosis. I am now at the camp that it is a massive underdiagnosis. And also, who are we to say that there's too many people being diagnosed with autism? Who are we to say that? Like, we have been poisoning our children. Last year was the 90-year anniversary of us injecting mercury and aluminum into babies. 90 years. Who are we to say that there's too many people with brain injuries and these disorders? Who are we to make this up? Like, I just have to think that there's just like pharma people online going, it's overdiagnosis. There's too many people. It's just natural variations. Like, they have to know, right? Or is it completely lost history even for the pharmaceutical companies? But I mean, it goes back to 1932. And there's people who've written just phenomenally about this. Forrest Moretti has a book called The Autism Vaccine. Mark Blaxall has a book called The Age of Autism. And they really dive into this forgotten history for us, because people want to say it's been around forever, right? If it's been around for 90, 95, whatever years, then that means it's genetic. Like, no, do you know how long we've been poisoning our babies? For equal amount of time, like literally equal amount of time. The curves on these things are parallel. They just match each other exactly. And no one is allowed to talk about it. So Forrest Moretti's The Autism Vaccine, Mark Blaxall, Age of Autism, they both dive into the history of the diphtheria vaccine. And so diphtheria is this horrible disease that was sweeping across America in the early 19-teens, 20s, 30s. And other variations of the name of it in other languages, like the strangulation disease. Like, it's just awful what happens. And kids get these diagnoses, they can be dead in a day or two. You know, it was very, very serious. And the only vaccine that they had for it was the equivalent of, you know, we have a tetanus vaccine now, but you have the tetanus immunoglobulin. So if you're actually exposed, you can get those antibodies. It's like an antitoxin put in you. That's not the tetanus vaccine. It's different. It's just like with COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Getting the antibodies. Well, that was the only treatment they had made from horses. And what they were doing is they were prepping these kids for anaphylaxis inadvertently. It was called serum sickness. They get one dose because the treatment was three doses. Preventative treatment was three doses. So you're taking a healthy kid who already doesn't have diphtheria, giving them a dose, giving them a second dose, they're reacting, giving them a third dose, a lot of kids died from it, right? I mean, I'm the parent of an anaphylactic child. You've got 45 minutes to 2 hours and they're dead. So that's what this vaccine was doing up until they were like, okay, we're going to stop using antibodies and these, you know, horse serums and stuff. And instead we're going to pivot over, we're going to take the bacteria and we're going to take this, you know, invisible at the time, nobody could see this toxoid that the bacteria secrete. And so that's what our vaccines are based on today. So the DPT becomes the DTaP in the 90s. And so it's diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. And all of those are toxoid vaccines. They don't contain the bacteria. They contain the gook and the schlud and just the poison and the toxicity that's secreted from this bacteria. And that's what our bodies are making antibodies to when you vaccinate a baby, is to the toxoid, not to the bacteria. Well, this was all brand new in 1931. And by 1932, it was the end of the first year of a massive national campaign. Like, this was the first vaccine campaign for children ever. And they had inadvertently discovered how much better it worked. It really can't work without it, is if they put aluminum in it. So it's already got mercury in it to keep fungus from growing. Then they add aluminum to it to make the body elicit this big response. And it also makes the toxoid be able to hang around in the body longer and not just be tackled and excreted and metabolized. It hangs around longer if you put the aluminum in it, giving the body a chance to build a response to it. That did not exist before 1932. And when you look at these kids, from Hans Asperger's first group of 200, like, Austria was doing this. Austria was like, that's a great vaccine. We're going to make our own version, right? Austria was doing this. And then here in the US, we had a psychiatrist named Kanner, K-A-N-N-E-R. And he was seeing classic autism kids and high functioning autism kids. And he's sort of lumping it all together. And there were 11 of these kids, and four of them had parents who were psychiatrists. Like, are you hearing? The first children in America had parents who were MDs. And in fact, one of them had a psychiatrist dad and a medical doctor mom. And the medical doctor mom is Dr. Peabody. And she was one of seven doctors at Johns Hopkins who advocated for the well baby visit, because you can never vaccinate a baby too young, or too soon, or too often. This woman was the parent of probably, I think, the number seven diagnosed kid with autism in America in the 1930s or early 1940s. Wow. They go hand in hand. There's no escaping it. They go hand in hand. And on top of that, there was mercury poisoning, right? Like, mercury was a miracle cure for so long. And then mercury crosses the placenta, you know, it stays in your body and then it crosses the placenta. How many generations is this going from mother to daughter? You know, the stuff is not studied. But anyway, my point is that autism and injecting mercury and aluminum, I mean, through history, there's not one without the other. So whose fault is it? Whose fault is it that this is happening? Whose fault is it that there's too many kids who are being diagnosed with high functioning autism? Whose fault is it that we are in an epidemic of gender dysphoria? It's our fault. It's not their fault. Like, these kids, that they're the last people whose fault it is.
It's a really refreshing angle to explore, in that, you know, in trying to wake people up to what's going on, just acknowledging that this is bad, you know, first of all, is huge, and then why it's happening is a whole nother thing. But I think I've become practiced in speaking to many of the other talking points that, you know, to kind of convince people as to, like, that one, this is happening, and that two, that it's bad for humanity. But I think in my realm, there is more emphasis on the corporate, like how it's being implemented. The ideology is being implemented. You know, there is a tactic amongst radical feminists to expose the top down takeover, which is like how it's being implemented in the law and language. And, you know, Kay Yang talks about how the UN is doing this on a global scale, institutionalizing the ideology of gender ideology. But yeah, for it to sink in, there needs to be a receptor. And you're speaking to why some children are more receptive to this top-down takeover. So it's not one or the other. Like you're talking to the particular makeup and the conditions of why one child over another child may not just encounter this, because we know all the kids are encountering it, but why one would latch also on and internalize. Yeah. So I'm just like integrating both, and I'm feeling like a merging of the two coming together. It's not one or the other.
Here's the thing is that we all see people like Billboard Chris, right? Who puts himself, or Alex Stein, right? But they put themselves in situations of high confrontation. And it's very easy to watch those confrontations and be like, they're right and they're wrong. They're the good person and they're the bad person. And maybe that's easy to do when you've got a 35-year-old, right? Who's just dressed
in full fetish gear, jerking right, off at a women's bathroom.
Right. It's easy to be like, you're the bad person, right? Okay, but then now let's go to the 28-year-old. Let's go to the 21-year-old. Let's go to the 17-year-old. Let's go to the 11-year-old. Let's go to the 7-year-old. Like, at what point can you see them as a child mm-hmm. that didn't ask for this and it's not their fault?
Of course. Of course. Yes. Yes. There is a massive distinction there.
That's who the 35-year-old is.
Right. I don't, yeah. Well, I don't know that I believe that the...
Well, it depends, right? The fetish thing, I mean, it could be completely separate, right? But yeah. I'm just talking about the trans rights rallies, things like that, right? Not necessarily
right. Like who are the people behind these masks? Who are the people? Like who,
yeah.
You know, who but are the people? The people behind, you know, the teenagers? Who are the teenagers holding up the signs that say trans rights or human rights? Are they all
are the
narcissistic?
People seven victims, right?
Right.
Those people are hurt. They're hurt internally. They're hurt in their brains. And they're all medicated. You know, they're all medicated.
Yeah.
And there's no autism medicines. And yet, like, what are we doing? We're putting all this on these kids. Yeah. I just, for me, it was eye-opening just personally to say, it helps me not other these people. Because that could be my kid. You know, we were on that path of vaccine injury. 100% we were on that path. That could be my kid. It could be anybody's kid. And I just don't want to other them because they're the victim here. And like, and does pharma know? Does pharma know? I think pharma knows, because I think pharma, I mean, I don't have any proof of it, but I think pharma's behind the lighted up blue and autism acceptance. And I think that they're behind mm-hmm. the rainbows every June, the, you know, the corporatization of it all. I think pharma's behind it, and pharma, I guarantee you, runs the World Health Organization. They run the UN, all of it. So all of this acceptance and changing our language, are they doing this to try to cover up an epidemic that they caused? I wouldn't be surprised.
Thank you so much, Robbie, for your investigative research, your time, you sharing your mothering journey with us, and you know, a bit today, and but more in our previous episodes. I know that this conversation is not, people aren't getting this anywhere. What you're sharing, people, I mean, this is really, I mean, talk about going beyond the surface headline. I mean, so just thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This is so important, and no one is going to hear it unless we start having these conversations on platforms like yours. So thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or family member who needs to hear this content. And if you do share it on social media, don't forget to follow and tag me at Whose Body Is It? So until next time.